From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1982, when an American diver became the first in a major international competition to get a perfect score of 10 from all seven judges. Greg Louganis went on to win two gold medals in the 1984 Games in Los Angeles, a double gold in 1988 at Seoul. But he is more than perhaps the greatest diver ever. Louganis lives with HIV, having been diagnosed in 1988, at a time when HIV was supposed to mean a very short lifespan. Well, he's 58 years old now, still living with HIV. He looks like he's about 38. He appeared in the 2016 ESPN magazine Body Issue, nude, by the way. He's a role model for fitness, for the LGBTQ community, and for HIV research. And he's working on a number of things in 2018. Here's just one of them. The Minnesota Vikings will become the first NFL franchise to host a large-scale summit focused on the inclusion of LGBTQ athletes in sports. The event next month will include Greg Louganis and other athletes. It will help address the question, can professional athletes safely come out without hurting their careers? Louganis is in Rochester sharing his story and discussing the science that has addressed the HIV epidemic on Second Opinion, WXXI's National Health Show. Greg recorded the program today in our studios, and that episode will air on WXXI-TV this coming November. But first, we welcome Greg Louganis to Connections, and it's wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And also with us is Dr. Bill Valenti, co-founder and senior vice president for strategic advancement, chief of innovation and staff physician at Trillium Health. And Dr. Valenti, welcome to you. Nice to see you again.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Bill, by the way, it's not just Greg who's been on television with us. I've got Bill's schedule. You were on Norman Company. Did you already take
yes,
that one?
It went very well. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Friday, May 25th, Saturday, May 26th, and then June 24th, Norman Company on WXXI-TV with the great Dr. Bill Valenti. When's the first time you realized the research you were doing in the 80s and 90s, and we've talked to Dr. Valenti many times about what was going on in the landscape of HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
When's the first time you realized that someone of Greg's profile was living with HIV? Do you remember?
Well, it was in the early 80s when... or the mid-80s when you first came out, and did I have the days right? Because the...
It wasn't until 95
right.
that I came out about my HIV status. Magic Johnson came out prior.
Like 92 or 3, I think.
Yeah.
And I remember those milestones because prior to that was the Rock Hudson
right.
Declaration, which right. was sort of put HIV... in people's heads, it became part of popular culture. Mm-hmm. At that point in the mid-90s, we had discovered the three drugs are better than two are better than one, but there were still a lot of people who were in AZT mode, that single drug therapy that was the mainstay for a very long time.
And so Greg, I want to work through a lot here, and there's a lot of different angles, as I mentioned in the introduction, a lot of the work that you're doing now. Mm-hmm. But I do want to kind of go back to the mid-80s. Here you are on the American diving scene, and I think when Barbara Walters interviewed you in the 90s, I don't know if you think she was overdramatic, but she said, you were winning all these gold medals, but behind the scenes, you were one of the unhappiest people on the planet. Was that overstating it, or was that true?
I think it's a bit overstated, for sure. I was diagnosed HIV positive 6 months prior to the Olympic Games.
In 88.
In 88. And so, you know, I was just kind of going along. I was training in Florida. My home was in California. And I was having ear issues, you know, an ear infection. And I told my doctor, who is also my cousin, that I wanted to do an HIV test because it was a very important year for me that year. And so we did the test, and then he got the results, and he said, can I come by and talk to you? And so then and then he told me that I was HIV positive. And at that time, I thought, if I was HIV positive, I was going to pack my bags, go back to California, back to my home, lock myself in my house, and wait to die. Because that's how we thought of HIV at that time in 88.
He told you in person, by the way?
He told me in person. He came by where I was staying, and we talked. And I told him what my thoughts were, and he said, you know, the healthiest thing for you, because we don't know how long you've been HIV positive, and the healthiest thing for you is to stay here, continue training, and I'll take care of the medical side. And we got an appointment with Dr. Anthony Fauci at the CDC, and it was. They wanted to treat me very aggressively, so they put me on AZT right away, and he looked after the health side while my coach took care of the physical side of preparing me for the 88 Olympic Games.
And so that brief moment where you thought, well, I'm not going to go to Seoul, I'm not going to do anything, I'm going to wait to die, they got you over that pretty quickly?
Yeah, you know, it was... It really probably was kind of a life-saving event for me, a life-saving decision, because then I could focus on something positive, which was my diving, and not so, be so obsessed or focused on my disease or illness. So it was, I think it was a positive thing for me, and also the physical activity. I think that's the reason why I was able to metabolize the AZT, tolerate the AZT as well as I did, was because I was so physically active.
Boy, how interesting. And then you think about what great athletes like Magic Johnson, Greg Louganis, the way the world reacted to the diagnosis. I mean, you know, we didn't know about your HIV diagnosis until the 90s.
Right.
But even in the 90s, mid-90s, I think Magic came out in 92 or 3. Mm-hmm. He goes, plays in the All-Star game. His career's winding down. And you had people going, well, he can't play in the All-Star game. What if he gets cut?
Yeah.
You know, and then people in the similarly, you know, they hear that you had HIV and they said, well, how could you have allowed yourself to go to the Olympics? And you hit your head on the diving board and, you know, not right. knowing that, you know, all of the things that would make it totally safe to do that. Mm-hmm. The world was really still struggling with that. Were you struggling with that? Were you scared?
At that time, sure, I struggled with it because I wasn't as well informed either. So I was still learning. So I was just going through the regimen. I was doing what I was told. I was showing up to my training sessions and also at that time when they were prescribing AZT was two pills every 4 hours around the clock. And so sometimes I would be forgetting to take my AZT, waking myself up in the middle of the night, in the middle of the morning. So my doctor got me a watch that went off every 4 hours, no matter where I was. I took my AZT. And he told me, he said, you know, just think of it like, he put it in terms that I could understand, that my training sessions and my medication, taking my medication was as important as showing up to my 8 o'clock workout. I was like, oh, okay, I get that. I understand that. So I knew the importance of that because it was something that I could relate to.
You were on AZT, but when did that regimen really start to change for you?
I can't remember exactly the exact year when.
Early, mid-90s, later? Because what I don't know myself is the actual progression of when we really did start changing the treatment approach.
Yeah. When did the protease inhibitors start?
About 90, between 92, 95. I mean, we learned eventually that three drugs are better than two are better than one. But
right.
Went from AZT single drug therapy to just adding a second drug.
Right.
So
right.
It was incremental.
And see, I was on the Norvir study.
Yeah.
So I was one of the patients that was on the Norvir study initially. And
tough
oh
drug.
My God, talking about brutal. It was tough, you know, one. It was the side effects were just horrendous.
Can you describe
horrendous.
Some of them?
Yeah. Within 20 minutes, explosive diarrhea. You know, stomach upset and just the lethargy. I mean, you just lack of energy. I actually was doing a play at that time, Larry Kramer's Just Say No, with Alexander Billings, who's transgender. And so, Larry Kramer, Alexander Billings, and myself all were upfront about our HIV status. So we were making notes, you know, comparing, okay, what are you taking? What are you taking? You know, and then when Larry learned that I was on Norvir, he goes, how are you doing this? I said, well, I adjust. I take, you know, I know when I'm going to be in rehearsal. I know when I'm going to be on stage. So I take it 2 hours prior because it usually took me 2 hours to recover mm-hmm. from taking the medication. And so I would time my dosages accordingly so that I could be at rehearsal, that I could be at a performance, that I didn't have those concerns of those side effects.
Sure. And was there any moment for you, whether it's going from one drug to two or whatever treatment regimen progressed at that in the subsequent years, was there a moment where you thought, I can live a full length of an average lifespan, that this actually could happen?
You know, it's really kind of evolved. I mean, because, you know, I'm on a three drug regimen right now. Basically because my doctor said, you know, because I asked him, I said, you know, well, I know that there's single drug regimens, you know, and is there a possibility that I only have to take one pill? And he said, well, you know what, you're doing so well on what you're on, kind of hate to try something, you know, and, you know, not fix what's not broken.
Sure. But it's working.
It's working.
And it does change. I mean, I think you've mentioned in various interviews that you mm-hmm. kind of want to try to stay ahead of it because HIV is sort of a clever disease.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a clever disease. I mean, because, you know, it becomes resistant to various drugs over a period of time. And so right now, I think the last, they have certain tests, a genotype, phenotype, you know, so that they can figure out what drugs might be effective to the virus that is in your body. And so I know that I'm resistant to any of the D-class drugs, the DDI, D4T, all that stuff. Relatively resistant to AZT because I was on AZT for so long. My doctor has me on a regimen that has been working. Viral load undetectable, T cells have never been higher. So I'm doing pretty good.
Dr. Valenti, how common is it for patients over the years to do exactly what Greg is doing, which is sort of making sure that you're not allowing any sort of resistance to develop and maybe mixing up what you're doing with HIV?
Well, I've been following a lot of patients for 20, 25 years or in some cases more. And there is that evolution in treatment, especially for the people who were around in the earlier days who started on one drug. And as the drugs have gotten better, more refined, different, the combinations of three drugs in one pill, we've evolved therapy and keep moving. And Greg's right also about the technology. It's a beautiful thing. Being able to predict what drugs will work and choose drugs better so that you get it right. And also the viral load test, which is critical, especially in the modern era, because when your viral load's undetectable, people don't transmit virus to others.
Right.
Right.
You want to just describe to the audience, Bill?
I just blew a kiss. To Greg McGinnis, by the way. just say it. But it is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel on a daily basis, Greg? You feel good?
Yeah, for the most part. You know, I'm 58, so...
Oh, don't give me that. I saw you in ESPN's body issue. I don't buy this. I'm 50. You look 38.
Oh, my God. No, but I mean, through the years, I've had my injuries. And so, you know, a lot of them, I have a, you know, bulging disc in my neck and a bulging disc in my lower back. And what I find for myself personally is that as long as I still stay active, then keep moving, keep active, then I'm usually feeling pretty good.
So. Let me go outside the HIV question, just ask you a general fitness question.
Sure.
Because you're here, and I know that, you know, you have been a role model in this. You don't get at the age of 56 to do a nude shot in ESPN's body issue unless you're looking amazing. And, you know, for me, as I get older, guys like Eric McCormack have been sort of my standard. Like, that guy can do it, I can do it. Now I look at you and I'm like, oh my God. What's the hardest thing as you've gone into your mid now upper 50s? What's the hardest thing to stay as fit as you have been?
The hardest thing, you know, for the physical thing, because I've been a lifelong athlete, mm-hmm. so it's easy for me to show up. And I think that's the most difficult thing for a lot of people is just to show up, you know, whether it be yoga, whether it be spin, whether it be CrossFit, whether it be, you know, any form of activity, physical activity. You know, and that's the most important thing is really kind of showing up.
It's easier just to say, I'm going to stay in bed.
Sometimes it is. I mean, sometimes it is. But, there's a lot of value in rest, too. So, you know, I also practice meditation. And so that is a great way, healthy form of kind of letting go, resting your entire body, mind, and maintain that, some semblance of health and well-being.
Yeah, I listened to an interview with Jason Terry, who's playing for the Milwaukee Bucks. He's in his 19th season, and they asked him this morning, you know, can you still perform? He says, performing is not the issue. In the off-season, you have to do all the work that gets you in position to perform, and the older you get, it's harder to convince yourself to do the same level work.
Right.
And that's all of us if we want to stay fit.
Yeah.
But it does sound like yoga is a big piece of this, of at least staying flexible.
Yeah. I mean, yoga is great. Obviously, I mean, you have to find the right yoga instructor. It's almost like searching for the right therapist.
Hmm.
Because there's so many different forms of yoga. Kundalini, you've got Ashtanga, you've got Vinyasa Flow, you've got Vinyasa Flow Hot Yoga, you've got Bikram, you've got all of these different forms of yoga. So find what's right for you in your body and mind, but also find the right instructor too, because there's a lot of yogi Nazis out there that are not real healthy as far as manipulation, mm-hmm. and being competitive and that. And that's not what yoga is.
Talking to Greg Louganis, who is in Rochester. He was in Rochester this morning for one of the reasons he's here, recording a program with Second Opinion, WXXI's national health show, and you'll be able to see that episode coming this November. So we're thrilled about that. And we're talking to him about his life in a lot of different ways. He's here. Dr. Bill Valenti from Trillium Health is here. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about how you see the landscape for gay athletes. You kind of came out in the mid-80s, and then you kind of came out in the mid-90s as having HIV. Was it easier to come out as being a gay athlete or easier to come out as having HIV?
I think it was easier for me to come out as a gay athlete, most definitely. I mean, because when I came out as being HIV positive and being a gay man, there was so much stigma surrounding it. I mean, I was on book tour in 95, and I had Fred Phelps was following me across the country, you know, with his placards outside saying, "Die AIDS, faggot, you'll burn in hell," and 666 on my forehead. And so I thought that was cool. I mean, because whenever he'd show up, I mean, it was a sold out event, standing room only. And I remember at one event in Lawrence, Kansas, and a woman stood up and said, "Well, Mr. Louganis, what do you think of the ignorance that's standing outside this building?" And I said, "Well, oh, you mean Fred?" And so they kind of chuckled. And I said, "Well, I feel like I should hand him a teddy bear and tell him he needs lots of hugs, because anybody who spews that much hate can't like themselves very much." And so the LGBTQ student union sent him a bunch of teddy bears in my honors, telling him he needs lots of hugs. And I thought that was like so cool, because when you speak, you don't know what people hear. You don't know what people's reactions are going to be. You're just sharing. So
that was Fred Phelps, you said?
Yeah.
I think the co-founder of the Westboro Baptist Church?
Yes.
So do you know the story of Megan Phelps Roper? I think his daughter or granddaughter. Do you know that story?
I thought it was his daughter.
His daughter, Megan Phelps Roper, left the Westboro Baptist Church on her own. Mm-hmm. She had sort of an awakening.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite stories that the New Yorker ever wrote called Unfollow. And listeners, if you haven't read it, you ought to read it, because in this era of tribalism, it's mm-hmm. easy to think no one will ever change their mind about politics or about anything. And Megan Phelps Roper, who grew up with the Westboro Baptist Church, she was in high school in Kansas.
Yeah.
And she would have lunch with her friends and then cut lunch short and go across the street and hold signs that said, you know, God hates fags.
Yeah.
And 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And she left on her own after people basically reached out via social media, and she started to really question, why do I believe this? So if she can change, anybody can change. I love that story.
Yeah.
And it's in the Phelps family. Megan Phelps Roper is her name. But you saw this, and it sounds to me, though, like you also felt a lot of love and support while you were dealing with the Fred Phelps and folks like that.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. And that was something else that I learned. I mean, the love and support was so overwhelming, especially on book tour. It was people coming to me and saying, you saved my life, because, like I said at the beginning of the book, that I felt like, because of this secret, my HIV, I felt like I was living on an island with barely a phone for communication to the outside world, because there was only a handful of people who knew about my HIV status. So there were not many people I could talk to about that and share. And I knew in my heart that I wasn't the only one, but I just didn't know how many. I didn't realize how many were out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, and not just HIV. I mean, this was cancer survivors, leukemia. I mean, just so many different, you know, situations, running across economic lines, racial, sexuality, whatever.
What did you fear the most in coming out publicly with HIV?
Well, my biggest concern was I did have a contract with Speedo, and I knew that there was a morals clause. And so I knew that the book was coming out in 95. My contract with Speedo was ending in 94. So I knew that I would be free and clear of that. But Linda Walkner said that she was the CEO, president and CEO of Speedo at that time. And she said, well, we want to negotiate for another number of years with Speedo. And so I said, Linda, we really have to sit down and talk. And so I was doing an appearance in Connecticut, and she had me over to her place in the Hamptons. And I told her, I said, I have a book coming out next year, and I'm coming forward with my HIV status as well as my sexual identity. And she's asked who my doctors were, to make sure that I was being well cared for, because she lost many friends in around her to HIV/AIDS. And so she wanted to make sure that I had a home, because that's what she saw and witnessed many of her friends losing their homes because of a partner dying and then being kicked out by the family because the home was in the deceased's name. So he saw all of these inequities and all, and she just wanted to make sure that I was taken care of and that I had a home. And she said that my commitment is for life. And so she was my champion. And so I felt like with her by my side, others will follow suit. And I was really hopeful. Corporate America can be a little slow on the uptake.
Sure.
So, it's nice to see people like Gus Kensworthy and Adam Rippon being able to come forward and actually having some sponsors kind of stand by them, and for corporate America to step up. During my time, I was lucky I had Speedo. That's all I got to say.
Because, that was, 23, 24 years ago
now. Yeah.
It's a bit of a different world at the time.
It was a different world.
That had to mean the world to you.
Yeah, it did. It did.
That's an amazing and hopeful story. And unfortunately, Bill, I think about your book and some of the stories you told of meeting people who were fearful that they could lose their family, their friends. Forget corporate support. Forget sponsors. Just the relationships. Sure. And it didn't always go the way it did with Greg and Speedo.
Right. Obviously, your CEO led the way.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of situations like that where people lost housing, insurance, employment, and the stigma, which, you know, still an issue today, but in the early days, because of the fear of contagion, was daunting at times. I think we've come a long way, but you also, as you were talking, reminded me of how stigmatized people, marginalized people, don't always access health care because they stay away, stay underground, feel less than worthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are all of those things to overcome. It's a tough road.
Well, we're having a conversation this hour with Greg Louganis, Olympic gold medalist four times over, an activist, an author in Rochester, because Greg's always going around the country being honored by various groups and whatnot, and that's true here. He's also here because Second Opinion, our WXXI's national health show, recorded a program with him today in our studios, and you can check out that program coming up on WXXI-TV this coming November. And Dr. Bill Valenti is here, co-founder and senior vice president for strategic advancement, chief of innovation, and staff physician at Trillium Health. I want to get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to explore a little bit more about Greg's work that he's going to do next month with the Minnesota Vikings. They're going to be the first NFL franchise to host a summit focused on inclusion of LGBTQ athletes in sports. And I want to talk about a number of things related to that. I want to ask Greg how he sees, you know, sort of the green light for athletes to come out, if there is one, in various sports, or if that typically happens in major team professional sports at the end of athletes' career, Jason Williams perhaps, and cases like that, or if we're going to start seeing that change earlier, what it would take to see that change earlier, how that compares to Olympic athletes. You mentioned Adam Rippon and others that have been very successful, and if there's maybe a difference that he sees or not, and how our kids and next generations are maybe changing the landscape as well of inclusion. So Greg Louganis, Dr. Bill Valenti, and this only break, and we're coming right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we end the week on a much-needed lighter note, a conversation about ovation inflation. The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Guardian, just about everyone covering the subject, why are there so many standing ovations these days? Are we diluting the value of a standing ovation? Is this the adult version of everyone gets a trophy? Is it time to change that? Weigh in with your thoughts on the culture of the audience next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Some of our listeners have asked just about coverage of what we're seeing out of Houston, Texas. NPR News, among many others, reporting that at least 8 dead now at a Texas high school shooting today at Santa Fe High School. And the suspect, as described as a current student, is alive and in custody. And NPR will have coverage of that, of course, throughout the day and when a lot more information becomes available. So Connections continues as normally scheduled today, but please stay with NPR, npr.org, for more coverage on that. That's fortunately the world we live in. There's a lot of pain, and there are a lot of young people struggling with various issues. I want to turn back to the subject at hand here, because if you are a young person struggling with identity, Greg, there's a lot of gay athletes at the high school level who don't know if they can come out. Sometimes we look to adults, we look to professional ranks for that. Mm-hmm. Pro sports has been very slow to embrace and sort of open the door for athletes to be gay in the middle of their careers or at the beginning of their careers. Mm-hmm. Jason Williams in basketball at the end of his career, some others. But not always safe for them. Do you see it changing at all?
I do see it changing. I mean, we have some organizations that are out there. We have Athlete Allies, which is United States based, and then All Out Sports, which is international. I also work with Gerard Toy, who is an Olympic rower, with Crossing the Line, which is an international, kind of helping athletes in transition out of their sport, because that is an issue. And we also deal with the sexual identity and all that. But the encouraging thing that I see is that I'm reading a lot of stories of young people in high school who were struggling with their sexual identity, coming out, and then afraid to come out. Then they approach their coach, and then their coaches are supportive, and then they make the announcement with the team, and then they find out that their teammates are supportive. It's like, well, you're the same person, you know, that I played next to, and so why would that change? So I think that I think we're going to see it from our youth first. Maybe not this generation, you know, because I think that there's still that stigma. I think we have some barriers where we have sports agents who really don't know how to represent a gay athlete or a HIV positive athlete. I don't think they know what to do with them. And you know, and also to have more corporations, corporate America, kind of coming forward, like I've spoken at General Motors and HSB. Those things are very valuable, and also talking to the Minnesota Vikings, having this summit, opening that door of conversation to where it's. We're not shying away from it, and just kind of putting it out there, and oftentimes it's a learning, and it's funny because the LGBTQ community, we think of that as a community. Well, the way that I explain it is like, originally I knew a lot about the G in the LGBTQ. I didn't know a whole lot about the other stuff, and I had to learn. And I've been blessed that I've been able to do a play in Chicago with Alexandra Billings, who's transgender. I've been able, you know, I have numerous friends who are lesbian, who identify as lesbian. I have a number of friends who identify as pansexual. And so it's an interesting research that to be able to be exposed to, and also to give awareness of how we can speak to each other and how can we speak respectful to each other.
When it comes to locker rooms, team sports, if the Vikings are going to be direct about this, and number one, I think you got to applaud them for at least having this kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is unfair, but in my stereotypical mind, I feel like the NFL is the last place where it's going to be easy to be gay. And what would you say to any team that says, look, in this sort of, for better or worse, socialized in the way that it is, hyper-masculine, et cetera, sport, with a team setting in a locker room, what can we do to help athletes feel like you can be who you are?
I think especially in those times, we look to those leaders, whether it be your team captain or your coach. You know, we look how they are going to react. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those are the people that we take our cues from oftentimes of what is acceptable and what's not. I mean, I can look at my diving career, and yeah, I was at a competition, and it was like the Fag Buster campaign. And so a friend of mine was so upset, you know, she's tearing down these signs, and she, you know, I went to her and I said, why are you so upset? She said, oh, you know, these divers are so small-minded. And I said, you mean the Fag Buster campaign? She said, oh, how do you know about that? It's like, oh, you missed the signs in the men's room. So she didn't get to the men's room. But, you know, I knew about that. And what's interesting, as time has passed, and I've been in touch with a lot of these people, I don't know how much of it was really true homophobia and how much of it was jealousy because I was winning. And I think the majority of it was that I was winning. It was jealousy. Because they really didn't have a problem with my sexual identity. You know, I can name one that I can say wasn't quite the case, but.
Okay, but I think that's encouraging.
Yeah.
And for the listeners who are may not know the context. This was in the 80s when the movie Ghostbusters was popular.
Yes.
And so the campaign that you described, they were actually using Ghostbusters like signs?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it was fag with the Ghostbusters not sign.
Very clever.
Yeah.
You also have said that while you were dealing with that from other divers, mm-hmm. you had an agency, Philip Morris?
William Morris.
Yeah. Not the smoking
guy. Yeah. Philip Morris is cigarettes.
It'd be weird if you were repped by them as a world-class athlete. William Morris, who...
Well, Mission Viejo was.
What's that?
Mission Viejo, Natadores was. I mean, that was a part of the conglomerate.
Wow.
Yeah.
See? Look at all these assumptions. Wow. You know? Okay.
but they also did golf, and they also did
Okay,
NASCAR.
But, yeah, I just don't think you want to have a sculpted body and be an Olympic diver. Grab a cigarette. But with William Morris in the mid-80s, you know, you're still navigating what it meant to be out, and it sounds to me like you were the kind of athlete who your coming out in the 80s wasn't like a declaration moment.
No.
You just started living that way, but then people started talking to you like, hey, tell me a little bit about what that was like from the agency repping standpoint.
Well, I mean, I was out to my family and friends.
Yeah.
They knew about who I was, you know, my identity. You know, in diving, it was pretty well known about my sexual identity. And then when I signed on with the William Morris Agency, then they said, well, just tone down the gay thing. And so I was like, oh, okay. And so it was just my policy not to discuss my personal life in the media.
Is that what they meant? When somebody says to you, tone down the gay thing, what does that actually mean?
I really didn't know. I mean, in a sense, you can interpret that as, you know, okay, we want you back in the closet, or don't talk about this, or, you know, giving limitations of what, you know, what you're going to share with people. My interpretation of it was just not to discuss my personal life with members of the media. And, you know, I felt that, you know, that's fair because everybody's entitled to a personal life. You know, not everything has to be out there. And that's kind of how I kind of justified it in my mind. But that's why I really applaud Matthew Mitchum. He was a diver from Australia, won the Olympic gold medal in Beijing, of all places, against the Chinese. And he came out while he was competing in the sport because he felt like he couldn't be as good as he wanted to be only by sharing a portion of himself. And to be, you know, true to himself, authentic to himself. So that's the reason why he came out. And it was that the coverage of that Olympic Games was on Matthew Mitchum was a little disappointing. You know, they never acknowledged his partner, they called him his special friend, and they kind of danced around the whole thing. That's where you kind of see, you know, there's a lot of education that needs to happen. And also those lines of communication of being able to express who we are and also with so many young people now, they really identify themselves as sexually fluid. They don't know. They don't want to identify one. They resist labels, you know. And all of us are more than what we label ourselves as, or what others label us as.
Sure. And as I listened to Greg Louganis' story of what life was like in the mid-80s as a world-class athlete, winning Olympic medals, dealing with an agency saying tone down the gay thing, thinking of his fellow athletes who might be professionally jealous, but trying to attack him in a way that they thought could hurt him because of his sexuality. My mind goes to a contrast. I think someone like Johnny Weir, who has not been told to tone down anything, mm-hmm. now he's got the job because I think he and Tara are excellent analysts. And mm-hmm. I as someone who doesn't watch a whole lot of figure skating except for when it comes on the Olympics, they really help me. And they're outstanding at what they do. But in terms of how he lives his own truth. Doesn't sound like anybody's telling him to tone it down. Do you see, is that just one case and more of an outlier, or do you think that's a sign of the progress that you didn't really have in the 80s?
You know, it's hard to tell. I think right now it's an outlier, you know, for sure. Okay. I mean, because Johnny, I mean, he's wonderful. I mean, he knows this is an act. He refers to him as his costumes. And so, you know, he's playing, this character. So it's, it works for him. And it's working for him to get, to get work. So, I applaud him for that, because it's also giving young people kind of a glimpse into possibilities. So, and I think that is always helpful and beneficial to our youth.
But it's interesting because maybe what I'm hearing from Greg is that Johnny's case is he's obviously doing very well for himself. Mm-hmm. But it sounds to me, and I don't want to speak for you, it sounds to me like you're going to think we've got real progress when every time a gay athlete gets out of the pool or gets off the court or wherever the case may be, when they're embraced by a spouse or a significant other who is not a typical man-woman, the old societal construction, and that the cameras don't shy from it, and that the announcers treat it just like they do any couple, then we will feel more sort of normalized.
Right, yeah, because it... Michael Sams, when he kissed his boyfriend, and that was like major news. It's like, and also for us, as a gay man, being comfortable with saying, "Oh, this is my husband."
Yeah,
and it's just like when I find when I do that more often. I do that, the more comfortable I am with it, and the more often I'm doing that. And I mean, I remember my husband and I were shopping one time, and we were at the mall, and we were at this little vendor. He was like, I have a tendency of chasing shiny objects, so I'm like in front of the jewelry store, and looking, and so I come up and then my husband says, "Oh, this is my friend, Greg," and he introduced me, and I said, "Excuse me?" And then I went to the gentleman and I said, "I'm his husband."
Did you laugh or did that hurt?
I laughed because I understand that. I mean, because you're kind of conditioned. I mean, especially this generation that I'm from, we're conditioned a certain way of how to speak and all that, and who we can speak different ways to. Because I understand camp, girlfriend, she this, that, and the whole gender kind of, juxtapose type thing. I'm not a fan of it, but, I mean, somebody called me girlfriend one time, and I said, "Excuse me?"
So, but you bring up a good point about authenticity.
Yeah,
I mean, you've used that a couple times, and we talk about that in even in our patient experiences, and it's hard getting there. It's not always easy getting there, but
and I think that it's wonderful because like when I go to colleges and universities, and especially LGBTQ groups, youth groups, we go around the room and we introduce ourselves, and then we say what pronouns we prefer. So and for some of the the members in the room, that can change from day to day. So it's just kind of out of respect of how we kind of see ourselves that day.
I think it was 10 years ago. I was back when I was anchoring commercial television news. I was anchoring with. He's out and proud. He didn't care. He's in another city, but he's a good friend. Edward Moody, one of the most talented people I've ever worked with. Edward is black and gay, and we were going to break, and he was going to say something, and then he pulled back, and we go to break, and I said, "Like what?" And he said, I can't say it." And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, you're a straight guy. You can talk anything you want about a girlfriend or a wife or whatever." He said, "I can't say, 'Oh yeah, I was there with my boyfriend last week.'" He said, "I still don't think I can say that."
Yeah.
And then he got really quiet, and I got kind of emotional, and I thought, like, that really hit me. He didn't even feel like he could say it in the cheesy anchor banter that dominates the news. We're always talking about silly stuff like that. Yeah. Now, I'm at least happy to say now, Edward feels very differently. But that was a hard moment for me to see how privileged I am that I never even have to think about that.
Well, that's been kind of the educational process of the straight community and our allies. You know, that's the reason why I do so much work with All Out Sports and Athlete Allies. It's so important that we celebrate our allies, because our allies really want to learn. And also, they're going to be our greatest advocates. Because people are going to listen to them.
Well, before we lose the hour, I want to ask both of our guests to define what they mean by allies. That's a term we hear a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I want to ask Bill about, you got an event tomorrow with HR. What's going on tomorrow night with
HRC?
With HRC. So I just looked at the clock and I went, oh my gosh, we've got like 4 minutes left. Define ally for me, Greg.
Basically, ally, somebody who's not going to stand by and will stand up for someone.
Pretty simple.
Yeah.
I think it sounds to me like your optimism on the future for athletes is that right now, you're right, it's coach, it's captain, it's top-down sort of policing discrimination or a lack of inclusion. Mm-hmm. I think kids now are going to grow up and be much more likely to police that themselves. Yeah. They're going to step in at a Starbucks when they see two black guys get arrested when all the white customers who didn't order coffee are not getting arrested. They're going to call it out instead of just sort of standing still. They're going to call it out in a locker room if someone is making fun of a gay athlete, more so than maybe our generations have.
Yeah.
In a very simple way, I think allies are more naturally sort of galvanizing in that way. Bill, how do you define ally?
Well, it's someone who's sexual orientation or gender identity are different than mine, who still accepts me. The classic example, of course, is the straight or the heterosexual man or woman who has gay friends and invites them to the house and is serious about advocating on their behalf, because they do it because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I think the important thing too is that we all learn to support each other. I think this administration has challenged us. You know, I was at the Women's March. I was at the Never Again March. We all need to come together and support each other, you know, no matter what color our skin is, what our religion is, what our sexual identity is. We all need to come together and support each other.
Human rights, and you might know HRC, Human Rights Campaign. What's going on tomorrow, Bill?
Big dinner tomorrow night at the Convention Center starting at 6 o'clock. Human Rights Campaign, a national LGBTQ advocacy organization. The Rochester Regional Group is getting together for their annual dinner. Guests, auction, the usual kind of thing, camaraderie, and supporting an organization that does some good work, what we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you have an enjoyable evening there, filled with allies, I'm sure.
Indeed.
Speaking of. And by the way, Bill, when you talk about, you know, just having friends who are different than you, sort of normalizing relations, standing up for them, I would guess, and this is not a softball question, I'm just asking honestly, a trillion organizations that support gay rights over the years throughout the course of your career don't just succeed with contributions from gay people supporting the quote-unquote gay organizations, et cetera. You've probably got a lot of straight allies who support you in different ways.
We do indeed. Many straight allies who are understanding of, supportive of our mission, our activity, the things that we do, and the people that we serve. So, it's a very broad mix of donors. Local philanthropy is very solid that way.
Okay. And Greg, down to our last minute or so here, anything that we missed in your projects and what's next? What else is going on with you?
What else is going on with me? Oh my God. We're working on a biopic. The producers are in London and we're locking down the writer right now. So excited about that. Working on a clothing line. I have a lot of things. I'm actually writing a musical with a couple of friends of mine.
Awesome.
Judy Norton is writing the book, Patrick Allen Casey's writing the music and lyrics. And so we had a industry read last year. So we're on our rewrites right now. So we're working on that.
Oh, that's awesome. Great stuff. Well, you've been very generous with your time. I was going to ask you when the last time you really dove seriously. I think for the body issue, you attempted something you hadn't done in like almost 30 years, didn't you?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, it was like, okay, go up there and do a backdive pike.
Oh, for the issue.
Are you kidding me? I haven't done that like in like, 30 years.
And yet I saw the picture. And,
yeah.
You did it.
Yeah.
You've been an inspiration to many, many people.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you for taking the time to be here.
My pleasure.
Greg Louganis, he's also going to be featured on Second Opinion, WXXI's National Health Show. You can see that episode coming this November. You can see Dr. Bill Valenti on Norman Company coming up in a week. That's next Friday, May 25th, 8:30, Saturday, 26th at 6:30. Thank you, Bill. I'll see you here much more than I'll see Greg, but it's great to have both of you.
Thank you.
As always, Bill Valenti, Greg Louganis, much more connections coming up.